It is Ryan here, and I have a question for you. What do you do when you win? Like, are you a fist pumper, a woo-hooer, a hand clapper, a high-fiver? I kind of like the high-five, but if you want to hone in on those winning moves, check out Chumba Casino. At ChumbaCasino.com, choose from hundreds of social casino-style games for your chance to redeem serious cash prizes. There are new game releases weekly, plus free daily bonuses, so don't wait. Start having the most fun ever at ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void or prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
Judy was boring.
Hello.
Then Judy discovered ChumbaCasino.com.
It's my little escape.
Now Judy's the life of the party.
Oh, baby, mama's bringing home the bacon.
Whoa, take it easy, Judy. The Chumba life is for everybody. So go to ChumbaCasino.com and play over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. ChumbaCasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Welcome back, everybody, to the Movie Palace. I'm your host, as ever, Carl Sweeney, and I'd like to wish you all a very happy new year. And thank you for joining me for this episode, the first episode of 2020, in which I'm going to be discussing the 1931 Dracula, starring Bela Lugosi, directed by Todd Browning. And I'm delighted to be joined for the first time in a little while by Rosie Powell. Hi, Rosie.
Hi, Carl. Thanks for having me back.
Yeah, it's been a while, isn't it? We were just talking about it offline. Yeah, it's been too long. Sorry, Rosie.
No, it's not your fault. We've both been very busy.
It's true. Well, we had intended to talk about Dracula. This was supposed to be our Halloween episode, wasn't it? It was supposed to be a follow-up to our previous Halloween episode on Frankenstein. But it's kind of timely now, isn't it? Because we're here in January, but we've just seen a new adaptation of Dracula on the BBC, yes. Written by Stephen Moffat and Mark Gatiss. I believe it's just gone on Netflix and various other places around the world, so people might be checking it out. So yeah, we've got plenty to sink our teeth into here, haven't we?
Nice pun.
Sorry, I'll try not to be a pain in the neck.
Oh dear.
We've been spoiled recently, haven't we, by literary adaptations on the BBC, haven't we? Because we've had The War of the Worlds not too long ago. Mm-hmm. There was a new Christmas Carol.
Yep, and His Dark Materials as well.
His Dark Materials, yep. And now Dracula. So what have you made of this new iteration of Dracula? You've seen the first couple of episodes, right?
Yeah, I've yet to watch the finale.
And I guess we can stay quite general because, you know, there are some plot twists and turns in this one and people might not have seen it yet. So yeah, what did you think?
I thus far really enjoyed it. I feel like it was a refreshing take on the original Stoker story with just the right amount of dark humour and gore. And Mark Gatiss and Stephen Moffat, you know, they're skilled in successfully revising classic stories as they did with Sherlock, albeit a little bit differently, but
yeah.
I think this just shows me up as a bit of a Gatiss Moffat super fan.
Yeah.
But enjoying the Easter eggs to do with Doctor Who, Inside Number 9 and Sherlock, they've been hinted. So yeah, I've enjoyed the first couple of episodes. And I think Claes Bang, I might be saying his name terribly wrong. I think he's kind of exuding sexy camp, and it's an interesting one. I know a couple of people have kind of been a bit not that enamoured with him, but I think he's done a good job thus far, and I really like the casting of Dolly Wells as well as Sister Agatha. Yeah, I love that she's a progressive proto-feminist type nun. So, yeah. What about you?
I think let's start with the positive. I think there's a lot to enjoy about this new iteration of Dracula, actually. I think it's clearly made with like a high degree of affection for previous on-screen versions of the story. So I think it's a lot of fun to look out for nods to some of the earlier films. It's kind of cool that some of the exteriors were shot in the same location as Nosferatu was.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's very bold. I think it makes big changes to the Stoker novel that go beyond what most other adaptations have done. And I won't say too much more about that, but I enjoyed many of the story choices they made. So it's fun, for instance, to see like a relatively brief passage of the book you know, the ships crossing, which is fleshed out into basically a full episode, isn't it? Mm-hmm. I think as a strong cast, especially, yeah, Agatha I really liked, played by Dolly Wells, really enjoyed her presence. Mm. It unfolds with a real exuberance, almost in a kind of frenzied way, that I think will prove a bit divisive. I almost feel like I need to watch it all again to process the sheer amount of stuff they threw at the screen, you know?
Yeah.
And I don't think, like, everything they try comes off perfectly, but I do respect the ambition. Like, I think I used the term hot mess to describe it on Twitter.
Yeah.
Like, it feels like a series that's it's in this state of disarray, but it's just about keeping it together, you know? It's never more than a few minutes away from just spinning completely out of control. But every time I was starting to feel like kind of ride it off a bit, it conjured up something really, really cool and arresting. So in a sneaking sort of way, I kind of like that. I like chaotic, messy stuff, and that's what I think this Dracula is. So I'd give it a more qualified recommendation. I think this is one, though, that people's mileage will vary on, won't it?
Yeah, I mean, it's, yeah, when with a tale as old as Dracula, it's been done so many times. Vampires, yeah. You know, we've gone from Nosferatu to Sparkle Sparkle, Robert Pattinson. So yeah. It's, yeah, but I liked it.
I would encourage people to check out the first episode, and I think you'll know by the end of the first episode whether this is for you or not. I think if you don't like the first episode, I think it's unlikely that the second and especially the third episode will change your mind. But if you're into it, then I think there's a lot to be enjoyed there. But you make a good point that, like, vampires have enjoyed really long-ranging appeal in pop culture especially, haven't they?
Yes.
For storytellers and for audiences. And why do you think that is? Like, why do we keep being drawn to stories about vampires?
They're just the magnetic, aren't they? They have a magnetic presence, particularly Dracula.
Yeah.
And they're inherently antiquated, but enigmatically modern, I'd say. I mean, they're never... You can adapt them to any sort of situation. If you look at, you know, how many versions of Dracula... Yeah. Dracula's been portrayed by more actors in a visual media adaptations than any other horror character.
Mm.
Yeah, if you go through them all, you know, from Max Schreck... for talking film, Max Schreck and Nosferatu, through Christopher Lee, Leslie Nielsen, Gary Oldman, Luke Evans,
Adam Sandler.
Yeah, Adam Sandler. there's so many versions, and I think I don't know if you know the website Cracked, but they had a video series called After Hours, and they go through what each kind of big monster like zombies, vampires, aliens and ghosts, what they kind of mean from a cultural aspect. And Katie Willett in that video said that vampires are how liberals are perceived by conservatives, a sexually ambiguous outcast that suck the lifeblood out of society. Mm. Which, if you go from that kind of that, if you take that and make it more basic, if you think about vampires reflect the anxieties around corruption, and certainly, you know, they're kind of inherently they're inherently evil, but equally there's something that draws you to them, whether it's hypnotically or otherwise. And I find that there's a weird connection between, well, probably perhaps not that weird, between vampirism and serial killers, because... They do cross over a little bit, if you think about it.
Yeah.
But in their activities and their vices, they're all deemed incredibly, like, macabre, but equally fascinating.
Mm.
And if you take, like, the crossover historically in the case of Fritz Haarman of Hanover in 1924, who went round, he was a serial killer and cannibal. He was the vampire of Hanover. That was kind of quite fresh in the memory of German, you know, and sensationalist, if it got through to European newspapers and things, that story. It's quite present, 1924, when the original play that the 1930s Dracula is based on. Yeah. Yeah, I think there's, you know, they're kind of, amusingly, if you hold up a mirror, you're not going to see a vampire, but yet they are kind of a mirror to what society could become.
Well, yeah, I think... It seems kind of appropriate that it's a subgenre that's kind of indestructible, isn't it? And it's notable, isn't it, that unlike something like Mummies, like which they do come up again and again in pop culture, but not in quite the same way, not with quite the same frequency.
Mm-hmm.
Vampires really have enjoyed this consistent, widespread attention. And I don't know, part of it, it definitely just seems like a lot of it is the potential to use the vampire story to create an allegory, doesn't it? So
yeah.
your story's about these undead creatures, but aren't really, you're talking about ethnicity or migration, fear of the other, disease, sex, whatever it may be. And like you say, you can do it in really different ways, can't you? Like, you can really play up the repulsion of these creatures, like something like Nosferatu does, or you can take the opposite tack, make them very glamorous, cast very desirable stars as vampires. You can put them in a contemporary cityscape, do a tale about urban living, or you can do these period pieces with very aestheticized settings. You know, you can really amp up the gore, or you can play it for laughs, like something like Hotel Transylvania does, or Dracula Dead and Loving It, for instance. And they cross national boundaries too, don't they? Like, we've had things like Let the Right One In.
Yes.
That are very effective too. So, and also, I think one of the reasons that they stand out from things like Mummies is that you often see vampires presented as very, like, empathetic figures as well, don't you?
Yes. Yeah, you do.
So it just seems like a very malleable form, and it seems like the vampire film's just successfully been rejuvenated a number of times, and Stoker's Dracula has proved especially media-friendly, hasn't it? Because it's not like he invented vampires or anything. They're already well-established, but I guess he was able to bring them to the masses. And even his book, it sold okay, and then it kind of picked up this appeal later on as well, didn't it?
Yeah, it did. I think because he had that interwoven story of like what where he got Dracula from.
Mm-hmm.
It's because Dracula is a culmination of kind of Romanian folklore and Vlad the Impaler,
yeah,
and his own personal experiences with Sir Henry Irving, who apparently fed on others. Not obviously in a literal sense, but kind of more like a Demento if you're a Harry Potter fan.
Yeah.
So yeah, he both in kind of amalgamating a real person and this mythological sense of how frightening vampires can be. And if you think in America, I think the last recorded real vampire, I use real in air quotes, case was in 1892.
Mm-hmm.
And then obviously you have vampires in Ireland and on the European continent, and drawing over from taking the European continent, you know, he's travelling into Whitby. It covers all of the West, so it's very much a very real threat, even though it's supernatural.
And also, I think for a lot of people, though, I think Stoker's Dracula is kind of inseparable from the on-screen representations of Stoker's Dracula.
Mm-hmm.
And I suppose one of the pivotal iterations of it would be this 1931 version, wouldn't it, with Bela Lugosi, the Universal horror film, which I just watched for the first time in a little while. So, yeah, what's your opinion on the Universal Dracula?
It's not my favourite version. But I'd say it's a classic, isn't it? It's
yeah.
It's a classic in all of its tropes and ideas, and on a basic level. It is rough around the edges.
Mm-hmm.
And if you watch it knowing kind of what preceded it and what will succeed it, it's a clear indication of the leaps and bounds Universal was making in horror at the time. And I think it sticks too safely to the play format for various reasons. It does mm-hmm. that, but yeah, it's, and obviously it hasn't dated well, but I mean, you gotta love the paper bats on string.
yeah.
And the thing is with Lugosi as well, he is Dracula. He is the Dracula, with Christopher Lee coming in a close second.
Mm.
I think, yeah, although he ended up being typecast, he's the most successful and the most visually kind of, when anyone says Dracula, you kind of immediately think of him.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah. So did you watch it for the first time ever recently?
No. Just the first time in a while.
In a while, yeah.
Yeah, because what happened when we covered Frankenstein, that was the same kind of thing. It had been a few years. And
with
that film, I was pleasantly surprised on rewatch. And to be honest, the same thing applies here. Like, this is a more compelling film than I remembered it being, actually. I think partly because it looks great on the Universal Monsters box set I picked up when we did Frankenstein on Blu-ray. It looks really great there. It's, I found it really enjoyable. I think it's atmospheric. It has some great camera work by Carl Freund. It's intelligently edited. I think this thing where Dracula doesn't seem to like enter the frame, you just cut to him and he's there. I really, really like that. It doesn't have a musical score, does it? Which is interesting. But and this is still very early in the sound era, of course. I think what that does is kind of add to this eerie, dreamlike quality the film has. I quite like the ensemble. I think Edward Van Sloan as Van Helsing is probably my favourite of the supporting cast members. But as you say, above all, it has one of the great horror performances at its centre, doesn't it?
Yes.
And I think it's Lugosi as the Count which really elevates this film. So yeah, I really enjoyed watching him here. And there's something about it, isn't there? Just kind of trying to peel back the layers of decades of pop culture references, you know, all the parodies, the imitations, and just trying to imagine what it must have been like to see this film and this performance for the first time in 1931. It must have been quite the experience, I think.
Absolutely. And if you, you know, put it in historically what was happening at the time with the Wall Street crash and the Great Depression.
Yeah.
Going back to what I was saying earlier, kind of having this film taps into the audience's idea of their own kind of economic lifeblood being drained away. So they need something not only to distract themselves that they can relate to. And at this point, this is the best thing that they have. And, you know, it had its difficulties and Todd Browning wasn't perhaps as into it as he ought to have been. But yeah, it was a huge craze. I think it had $1 million profit or something. And no one had really kind of seen Dracula like this. This was the first, because the play was the 1920s play was the first official adaptation of the Stoker novel. And then this was taken from that play. So it was kind of the first official line, as it were, of having a Dracula-type film. Obviously, it's not the first film with vampires, but... So, yeah, it was huge for Universal and for audiences around the world who got to see it.
Yeah, isn't there supposed to be, like, a lost Dracula film from Hungary? From like, I think it even predates Nosferatu. I don't know if it's an official adaptation or not. But...
It probably is, but I'm not counting it because it's lost.
Fair enough, yeah. Yeah, no, it massively profitable film, and there's something kind of sad about the fact that Bela Lugosi wasn't paid that much, actually. Do you know how much he was paid for this film?
Yeah, wasn't it like $3,500 or...?
Yeah, I'm looking at a book called Forbidden Hollywood by Mark A. Vieira, and that's the figure he gives.
Yes.
And he says that... yeah, he gives that figure. He says that he was offered a paltry $3,500, whereas... one of the other actors, yeah, David Manners, who plays Harker in the film, was paid $14,000, which is kind of interesting. But it's what you say, I think, like, Lugosi looks every inch of, like, the archetypal cinematic vampire, like, what that kind of figure should look like, doesn't he?
Yeah.
And some of that's the styling, isn't it? Like, the cape, the illuminated eyes, he's got, like, the slight widow's peak, which, like, would be exaggerated in a lot of subsequent vampire stories. But it's also his manner and his movement, isn't it? Like, he's very intense, but he's also charming. I think an enormous part of it is just his voice, isn't it? Like, the stories go that he learned many of his early parts phonetically. And here his dialogue just has that really elongated, uncanny quality, doesn't it? Like, that thing, you know, it's like, we will be leaving tomorrow evening. just indelible, you know. And I think that's what, if you asked anyone to attempt a Dracula impression, that's the kind of thing they would do. But the thing is that when you go back and watch Lugosi and you see it in the proper context, you realise that it's exactly the right way to play this particular character.
Yep, absolutely. It's archetypal. And yeah, as you say, anyone does a Dracula impression, it's going to be, you know, children of the night. It's going to be him. And Carl Emley didn't like him at all, did he? He didn't want him originally.
Apparently not, yeah.
Yeah, I was reading in Jonathan Rigby's American Gothic book that in spite of Lugosi's good reviews for the stage portrayal as Dracula, Carl Emley and the rest of Universal considered at least seven other actors, and originally, obviously, Lon Chaney would have been Dracula, but he died before, whilst this was kind of being considered, he died, and then they started looking for someone else. But yeah, it was just because he happened to be in Los Angeles and lobbied hard and won the executives over.
Yeah, had to fight for the role. Yeah, and I think maybe that's why they were able to kind of lowball him with his wages a bit, you know, because they knew he wanted to do it. And like you say, Lon Chaney and I think Conrad Veidt supposedly didn't want to do it. They had this list of other actors. And it's a very interesting like fork in the road, isn't it? Because like, if someone else gets this role, does the film end up being as big a success? And if so, like, how different then would our perception of like the ultimate cinematic vampire be today? Like, we can never know this, but it's interesting to kind of ponder, isn't it?
Absolutely, yeah. What if?
Because another thing that's interesting about this Dracula is they don't really go down the sympathetic route with him, do they? I mean, he does make a reference to there being far worse fates for a man than death at one point, but they don't really push that. I think some of the subsequent adaptations will get into that kind of thing a little bit more. And the other thing I liked about it is that Lugosi is really intelligently used in this film, I think, in the sense that we actually see him quite sparingly as the film ensues, don't we?
Yeah. Like,
there are quite fairly lengthy sequences where he doesn't actually appear. And I think that's wise. I think it kind of builds a sense of anticipation for the times when we do see him. And I wonder if the power of his presence maybe would have been diluted somewhat if he was used with a bit more abandon or something. What do you think?
Yeah, possibly. No, yeah, his presence is probably the most kind of, well, it's enigmatic and the most, I don't want to say enjoyable, but probably the best thing of the film in that it's used sparingly. Because that's, you know, that's the thing with monster films. The longer you leave it without seeing him, the better. Or seeing anyone out without, you know. It's always better for to have that, you know, where is he going to come next? Yeah, I still, as much as I mean, it's probably too early to talk about the Spanish version, but as much as I enjoy Lugosi, and I prefer Lugosi to Carlos Villarías's portrayal of Dracula, I think visually they use him better. I don't know what I just do.
In the Spanish version, you mean?
In the Spanish version, yeah.
Well, we could talk a bit about the Spanish version, I think, because you brought it up. Because, yeah, I'm not sure if everybody knows this, but at the time, because this is very early in the sound era, and I think dubbing hadn't really been adopted as a practice yet. So with this film, Dracula, there was a version made simultaneously in Spanish on the same sets at the same time as the American Dracula. So the American crew would work through the day, and then the Spanish language crew would come in at night. So yeah, there's even stories about like Lugosi hanging up his cape and putting it over his chair ready for the next actor to come in and use it and stuff like that. So it's fascinating. I mean, the closest example I can really think of is it's like watching the Gus Van Sant Psycho, which is like this kind of shot for shot thing. But it's even more kind of uncanny than that because it was literally filmed alongside the other version. Yeah. And it's fascinating. It's the Spanish version is quite different, isn't it? Like, it's half an hour longer, actually.
Mm-hmm.
There are little bits and pieces that are different, but mainly it's just because the scenes take longer to play out. And I think the kind of thing you hear over the years about the Spanish version, and I watched it for the first time last night, but it's that there's a bit more fluidity to the filmmaking. So like, when Renfield first enters the castle and sees Dracula, you get this big swooping camera movement towards the Count, for instance.
Yeah.
But it doesn't have that performance at its centre, does it? Like you say, the actor who plays Dracula is not as indelible as Lugosi is. And ultimately, I think that's a big thing, isn't it? That's where you feel the difference in a lot of ways.
Absolutely. And also, the guy who plays Renfield, Pablo Alvarez Rubio.
Yeah,
he doesn't beat Dwight Fry. I mean, Dwight Fry is amazing in the film, but so I feel like if you had amalgamated the two, because having read about Todd Browning's kind of indifference to directing and leaving a lot to Carl Freund, I feel like if maybe George Melford was given the opportunity to direct Lugosi and Dwight Fry in the English version, then it would have made for a better film overall. But yeah, I think the Spanish version, it has generally, people say it's better in that it makes more sense because it wasn't cut down like the Browning one. There's a better flow of narrative, although some people think it's kind of a bit boring. And the shots, because they could, some people in the cast and the crew would turn up early, so then they would watch what Browning was doing and think, oh yeah, well, we can better that. So that kind of helped. And also, like, the thing is with vampirism, it's very erotic. It's always got that kind of sense to it. And I think the Spanish one kind of exudes that. I know this is pre-code as well, but it certainly has a lot more kind of sexual tones in it.
It does. Yeah, I appreciated that. And I think you see it in like the female performers' costumes and things like that. Mm-hmm. You know, the sensuality comes through a bit more. I didn't like all of the things they did differently in the Spanish version. Like, you see Dracula, it looks like they raise him up on a platform or something from his coffin, doesn't it? You get this kind of puff of smoke and then he appears. I kind of liked the way the Browning film does that a little better, the way you just cut to him. But anyway, yeah. It's notable that, I mean, Dracula isn't really an alluring figure in Stoker's novel. I reread the first 50 pages or so last night, and he's described as, you know, he's just this old man with a big moustache and bushy hair. You know, and
they just described Tom Selleck.
Yeah. And like, I don't know, we get this thing where apparently the 20s play, which started in England before it moved to Broadway, it kind of portrayed Dracula as a bit more of a suave trickster figure. Because I think that plays more in the vaudeville tradition in a way. It's this big spectacle and it's doing some weird things with special effects and stuff. Had poor critical notices but proved popular with audiences. So I guess that starts the process, and then it's adapted for Broadway, Lugosi's hired, and then away we go. But I don't know, it's just one of those occasions, isn't it, where, because we can talk a bit about how it affected him and his career thereafter, but it's that thing where a star finds a perfect role and then finds it somewhat hard to disentangle themselves from it thereafter. I don't know what a perfect comparison would be. It kind of, Arnold Schwarzenegger in The Terminator comes to mind in a way. And yeah, apparently his life, Lugosi's, was utterly changed by Dracula, wasn't it? He apparently referred to it as a blessing and a curse. And he was buried in his cape, by his family. I don't think he'd expressed any wish for that to happen, but they took the choice because they thought it would be appropriate. So yeah, what's your familiarity with him from like his other stuff? I mean, I've only seen a handful of his films. I wouldn't mind doing a bit of a deeper dive at some point.
Yeah, same. I was just thinking when you said about them burying him in his cape, maybe they were hoping he'd come back. I haven't seen him in much else. I think he's really good in The Black Cat, but The Black Cat is a very, very good film. Isn't it?
Yeah.
And yeah, I don't know if I've seen him in much else that's not Dracula. Was he in Plan 9 for Outer Space?
Yeah, he works with Edward towards. Yeah. That's what people say is like his career ends on a really sad note, doesn't it? Because not just that he got typecast, but that he kind of lurches into self-parody. Although in some of those films, I watched a documentary on the Dracula Blu-ray, which is about him, and it seems like in films like when he's appearing in alongside Abbott and Costello, for instance, and like seems like he's kind of playing it straight, even though this kind of comic thing is going on around him, you know. But it's just kind of sad that, yeah, his career wanes not long after Dracula. It's like 4 or 5 years later, and he's typecast. He's getting shunted into supporting roles rather than starring ones. When he did star in films later on, they're often kind of Poverty Row films, you know, these kind of quickies that were made. And then the Edward stuff later on. So it's kind of a sad irony, isn't it? But like, ultimately, Martin Landau wins an Oscar, so like the ultimate industrial accolade for playing Lugosi in Tim Burton's film Edward. But Lugosi himself arguably wasn't treated that well by the industry, it sounds like, doesn't it? But
yeah,
it's sad. But I think what shines through in like what you hear people say about him and from his peers and so on is that he had a real tangible presence, you know, like he entered the room and people knew about it, that kind of thing.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting as well because, I mean, arguably Boris Karloff is the same, but then I don't, people might argue that Boris Karloff had the same experience because he was typecast as Frankenstein.
Mm.
Or as the mummy, you know. I suppose maybe because he did different roles.
Yeah.
But I don't know. Yeah.
Yeah, I wonder if it's because I think Karloff maybe managed to negotiate it a bit better perhaps. Yeah. But I mean, they were paired a few times. Like, they're in the Black Cat together, feels like the Raven. And you can see the appeal, can't you? Like, putting the two great classic horror stars together.
Well, yeah. They did it with Christopher Lee and Peter Cushing.
Yeah. And I think Karloff always seemed to have, like, top billing, though. It seemed like he was the bigger figure industrially. But yeah, I guess it's kind of like Lee Cushing, or like when Chaplin and Keaton appeared together, Davis and Crawford, De Niro, Pacino. But Lugosi was wanted for Frankenstein's monster initially, apparently he did a test or something, and that's fascinating to ponder too, isn't it? Like, would his career have panned out a bit differently if he'd got that part? Like, it might have meant that Dracula wasn't the only thing people thought of when they thought of him, you know?
Yeah. And also, it makes me wonder what would have happened if Lon Chaney had survived and played Dracula and then gone on to play everyone else. I mean, I know he had lots and lots of different roles, but, I mean, he wouldn't have lived until the 50s. Well, he wouldn't have been acting up into the 50s, but there's a certain set of circumstances that culminates in someone kind of being left, like Lugosi was.
Yeah, because if Chaney had played him, because he was so, you know, the man with a thousand faces and that kind of thing, you imagine maybe they'd have done something differently with the makeup. It might have been more of a physical, I mean, he was known for his physical contortions, wasn't he? So would that have carried over into his portrayal of Dracula? You assume it would have? I don't know. I mean, the thing with Lugosi and Dracula, it's one of those things, like, it's like with somebody like Hannibal Lecter in The Silence of the Lambs, but it's like where the discussion of a particular character always becomes disproportionate when you consider his actual screen time, has kind of this outsized effect. But yeah, I mean, what about Dracula as universal horror more generally? You were saying it's not really your favourite of this cycle. Is that what you said earlier?
Yeah, it's not my favourite. I just, as interesting as vampires are, they're not really my go-to monster. Like, if you gave me a choice of what to watch out of all of the Universal horrors, I probably would end up going for, you know, the classic Universal horrors, I'd probably end up going for Frankenstein. I mean, I love Todd Browning. I love Todd Browning's Freaks and The Unholy Three and, you know, his work with Lon Chaney and stuff. But I just feel like he didn't really put much into this. Yeah, even though it's about an othered individual, which was kind of very much a strong theme of his films, having read about his, it kind of made sense having read about his indifference and this kind of, he wanted to focus on the kind of horrible possible rather than the horrible impossible, if that makes sense. So, you know, focusing on things that could, creating films that reflected possibilities of what could happen rather than kind of directing and providing pure supernatural horror. So, yeah, I don't know. I just, if you gave me a choice, I probably would go Frankenstein. But equally, you know, it's still a fantastic film. It's still a film I would urge people to see if they haven't seen it, because it's a classic and because it helps you map the kind of, in terms of popular culture, the rumblings of where people get their Dracula adaptations from. Obviously not just from Stoker's book, but, you know, everyone will look at that. You know, obviously Christopher Lee looked at Lugosi and thought, well, how can I do this differently?
So about Browning, like you say, I've seen it suggested that he's a particularly decent choice for this because he had this affinity with outsider figures. And then he directed a film, Mark of the Vampire, a few years later, where Lugosi appears again. So what's the story about his indifference then? Because I don't think I came across that. What I did come across was people saying things like Karl Freund was a particularly assertive presence on the set. But what have you encountered about Browning here then?
So again, I was consulting my Jonathan Rigby American Gothic book, and I heard that Todd Browning couldn't be bothered. He was given this project, and after waxing lyrical about, oh, I'd never do a project that's like purely supernatural because I want to give the audience something that would really scare them because it's, again, horrible possible. And so when he was given Dracula, he was like, okay, fine. Originally thinking he would have worked with different people, but he ended up leaving most of it to Freund. This is what I've heard, or read, rather, which is where I think some of the ideas of George Melford coming in for the Spanish Dracula and kind of thinking, okay, well, Browning's done it that way, but I think I can do it better. And that's why generally it's thought of visually as better. I mean, obviously it's contended, isn't it? But Yeah, it was in the Rigby book mainly that I read that.
Yeah, that's very interesting. Mm. Yeah. I mean, it's worth noting that a lot of the contemporaneous reports about Dracula suggest that audiences were really shaken by the film.
Mm.
You know, stories about audience members fainting and that kind of thing. I mean, even if we assume there may be a bit of creative retelling in some of those stories, it's safe to say, I think, that a lot of people found this a very disturbing film. I guess if anyone hasn't seen this film yet, and maybe you're going to listen to the podcast, then check it out. But it might be hard for today's audiences to understand that, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
But I mean, this is a very old film now, of course. But I think seeing this film in a darkened cinema at a time when people generally hadn't seen like untold numbers of other vampire stories, it must have been a very powerful thing, mustn't it? And I think some of the things that we may read today as like staginess or melodramatic, or like overly melodramatic, I don't think they would have came across that way in 1931, would they?
Not at all. And if you think about, you know, the already kind of inherent unease of particularly American audiences, well, all audiences to be fair, but generally American audiences, of what was going on, they, you know, people would go to the cinema as a form of escapism.
Mm-hmm.
And this is escapism to the point of it's not a real situation that they could find themselves in, but equally it still, as I said, reflected what they were experiencing. And also, I've read somewhere, I can't remember where I read it, but they some of the theatres that it was being shown at hadn't had sound capability built into the actual cinema. Yeah. So that is also something to note with some of the long drawn out facial expressions, because they were still kind of, it's still, we're very early into the talkies at this point. And also, again, because it's based on a play, it looks like a play, you know, you can imagine it being in a play setting. It's very staid.
Mm-hmm.
But I did find, again, in the Rigby book, Donald Beaton of the film Spectator said in his review is, Dracula is one of the hardest pictures to criticise that I've come across in a long time. Bela Lugosi as Dracula was quite adequate. Having never met a vampire, I don't know exactly how one should act, but I presume that Lugosi is all right.
So wait a minute, where was that an American critic or a British critic? American. Now, did you know the word quite has a different meaning in America?
Ah, no.
Because quite means very to Americans. To British people, we generally mean it, we sort of mean fairly, don't we, when we say quite.
Yeah.
It's fairly good. So maybe that casts a slightly different light on the appraisal, I don't know.
Yeah, no, that probably would. No, that definitely does. But I just thought that fed into your, you know, looking back at, to try and think about how audiences then reacted to it. Dracula is one of the hardest pictures to criticise that I've ever come across because he's never met a vampire. So, and they don't know how they should act. And if people haven't read Bram Stoker's Dracula, you know, the people, the audiences of the time hadn't read Bram Stoker's Dracula, this is their first connection with it. It's an exciting connection to make.
Yeah, that thing you mentioned earlier as well, that the cinemas, not all cinemas, were properly equipped for sound films. So a silent version of the film was actually released in places, which they do include a few clips from in the documentary on the Blu-ray, which I assume would make a fascinating viewing experience. But you just would be missing the voice, I think, wouldn't you? I mean, I suppose if you didn't know what Lugosi sounded like, you wouldn't miss his voice. But watching it today, I think you would feel that. But yeah, worth noting that this is a rather different Dracula story than we encounter on the page, isn't it? I think this is a tricky book to adapt. It must be, mustn't it? It's quite a tough task.
Yeah, it jumps around a lot. And if you don't have the budget, and it's one of those ones that it's very hard to kind of get the right, not the right feeling, but the right measuring of each character.
Mm-hmm.
Because I think Jonathan Harker's absolutely useless in every sense of the word, except in the book, obviously, because it's from his point of view. But in pretty much every adaptation, I have, apart from, well, even this one, I mean, the most recent BBC adaptation was quite an interesting alteration of how Jonathan Harker ends up, you know. But yeah, I think whenever I say Jonathan Harker, I just immediately think of Keanu Reeves.
And his terrible English accent.
It's him, the man himself. Yeah, and certainly in certain like character development and things, it's very hard to adapt as well. That's what I'm trying to say.
Yeah, well, even you talk about Harker, but that's one of the big changes here, isn't it? That he isn't the figure who travels to Transylvania to meet the Count. It's Renfield.
Yeah.
Well, Harker's back in England. So yeah, I guess just overall, like you say, I mean, Dracula, the book, if people hadn't read it, it's this epistolary tale, isn't it? It's all done by correspondence and things, and multiple narrators, multiple protagonists. So you often get, I mean, certainly in the 31 version, you get a very simplified version of the story, don't you?
Yeah.
Like you say, very notable. It's credited as an adaptation of the stage play explicitly on those opening credits. The Transylvania section as well is a very brief one in the film, isn't it? And I think that's a bit of a shame, because that tends to be the section of the story I enjoy the most. But
yeah,
it's done fairly cursorily here, isn't it? Especially compared to the book.
It is, which is a shame. I don't know what the thinking was behind that. Do you?
I don't know what the thinking was, no. I have no idea. But it's like, it seems like, well, we only see Renfield there for one night, don't we? We're not sure exactly how, it abridges quite a lot of what happens between the two characters in the book.
It's frustrating if you know the novel and then watch it, but you don't lose, if you don't have any inkling of Dracula at all, you don't lose much. And I think Dwight Fry makes up for it with his portrayal of Renfield.
And I think it's worth saying that the Castle Dracula sequence in the film, it kind of nails the iconography that would in many ways become fixed in the popular imagination, doesn't it? Like, probably not in all the details. Like, we seem to see armadillos here, which
yeah, and an
seems
opossum.
A bit odd to me. Yeah.
I don't know why.
Which you don't normally see. But in most of the other details, things like the giant cobwebs and that kind of thing. And I think the camera work is important because, yeah, the camera maybe doesn't move as much as it does in the Spanish language film, but like that creeping movement towards the coffins early on, for instance, is very effective. Yeah, I think like the armadillos and everything, they seem to be fleeing the coffins, don't they? Is the impression you get in the that comes through more clearly, I think, in the Browning film than in the Spanish language one. But
yeah, it is. I didn't know if there was some sort of, you know, to try and, I don't know, because they're American animals, aren't they? But so why would they be in Transylvania? I mean, is there something particularly creepy about armadillos and opossums? They are the children of the night with the wolves, and I didn't really understand that. I would love to know the choice, but maybe it was the only animals that they could afford at the time. I don't know. They could have used a cat or something. I mean, cats are inherently,
yeah,
you know, renowned for being close to evil, even though they're not. But yeah.
I mean, it's other things too, isn't it? It's like Lucy is focused on much more in the book. In the film, it's treated a bit more sketchily, isn't it? So yeah, overall, it's a rather truncated version of the tale, isn't it?
It is. It really is. Yeah.
I mean, I think you have to allow for the fact that, first of all, visualising horror on screen, particularly at this time, is a very different thing to presenting it on the page.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, how difficult would it have been in 1931? Because like, in the novel, there's a lurid scene where Van Helsing and co. drive a stake through Lucy's heart. But I don't know how they could have done that properly, done justice to it in 31. So I guess we have to appreciate that, don't we? Very much a product of its time.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely, yeah. And although it is pre-code, it's still, you know, the Hays Code is coming in force not long after.
Yeah.
And yeah, with budgetary issues and just general kind of not wanting to push too far for extreme kind of shock value, shock factors. There's only so much they could do.
So, I mean, as we said, this is a seminal film for its place in Universal's history, in horror cinema history, for Lugosi, for the, you know, the representation of on-screen vampires. And Dracula, like you say, is just one of these figures who he never stays dead. We see him again and again and again. And we've got this new 2020 adaptation, and I'm sure it won't be too long until we see Dracula on screen, you know, again. So what are the on-screen Draculas have you particularly enjoyed? I'm guessing you said Christopher Lee would be a close second, right? So the Hammer Draculas you liked, yeah?
Yeah, if I had to pick a Dracula film to watch, it would be Christopher Lee's Dracula. just because, I mean, in popular culture, he's kind of, I think he's a close second for what people think of. Mm-hmm. But I much prefer, I don't know, I think that I'm looking at things through rose-tinted glasses, but I have a preference for Hammer over Universal. Yeah, I mean, I don't know. Other iterations of Dracula. There's Gary Oldman did a fairly good one, although I really don't like Bram Stoker's Dracula because I just find it too theatrical, and also awful acting. Well, awful accents, I should say. Yeah. But at least that's kind of the closest to the book. I don't know. I mean, there's so many different versions, isn't there? I mean, there's also Blackula, isn't there?
There is, yeah.
Yeah, I think Adam Sandler does a pretty good job as well. You've got, yeah, you know, you've got Denham Elliott, you've got David Niven, you've got so many.
Frank Langella.
Yeah. Yeah. But yeah, if I had to pick one, it would be Christopher Lee.
Yes. So I'm not the biggest Hammer fan. Now, it's not that I dislike them, but I just haven't gone through loads and loads of their films. So I've seen the first film that Christopher Lee played Dracula in.
Yeah.
I guess one difference would be the sexual implications of the story come to the fore a bit more in Hammer, don't they?
Yeah, they do.
And in a lot of the other adaptations, I guess.
Yes, yeah. Well, sex sells, doesn't it? So they say. Yeah. And also the relationship with Van Helsing is a lot stronger in the Hammer films, I feel.
Mm.
You know, it's kind of that almost Holmes and Moriarty, that, you know, duality.
That duality, yeah.
Yeah. That isn't really explored in the 1931 Dracula.
I did like the standoff between them, though. I thought that was quite an effective scene. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And the mirror scene is very, very good.
I think that's an example. The mirror scene is an example where the Spanish film tackles it rather differently.
Yes.
You know, you get cuts to the mirror and so on. You know, you see what Dracula sees, and it's a bit more elaborately constructed, I guess. But yeah, I'm just looking at the IMDb page for the 58 Dracula with Christopher Lee, and it says he only has 7 minutes of screen time. So that's not very much at all, is it? need to see that film again. Yeah, I'm sure. I wonder if there's some good Hammer box sets out. I'm sure there must be some good compilations. To track down. I mean, for me, I don't know if Nosferatu has ever been topped.
Mm,
I think Nosferatu's. I mean, obviously not a direct. It's not the same names and everything, but it's Dracula effectively.
It is.
And I liked that. And I seem to remember liking the. The Herzog remake too. If people haven't seen Nosferatu, I think that's well worth a look, isn't it?
Definitely. And if they can get it with a good soundtrack. I saw it at the Q Musical Museum with accompaniment on a Wurlitzer, which was amazing. obviously not everyone has access to a Wurlitzer, but as long as it's got a good musical accompaniment, I think. Yeah, everyone has to see Nosferatu. It's one of those classics. My bad for thinking forward rather than backwards. But what do you think about kind of the modern iterations of vampires, like in True Blood and Twilight and Penny Dreadful and things?
I haven't seen any of those, actually.
Okay.
I would like to give Twilight a go, because I've seen so much snobbery about Twilight that I feel kind of predisposed to liking it as a bit of a contrarian take, but I don't actually know. I guess Buffy the Vampire Slayer would be what springs to mind when I think of more contemporary vampires, but I guess even that's not that contemporary now, is it? I think it's one of those things. I think of the mid-90s as like 5 minutes ago. It really isn't at this point.
No.
I liked Buffy to a certain point. I think that was really good. What else have I seen? I'm not really sure, but I think to go back to the Gatiss Moffat version, it seems kind of in the lineage of stuff like, if you've set aside the vampire stories, it seems like they're attempting to do something kind of like what the Hannibal series did, doesn't it? It's that kind of thing, isn't it? So put the monster front and center. So we see much more of Dracula in this new version, don't we, than we've described in the 31 version, for instance, or the 58.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I don't know. Well, what's your opinion on like the True Blood, Twilight things that you mentioned? You like Penny Dreadful, right?
Yes, yeah, I did. And Dracula was quite interesting in that. Again, not very present. Not very present, but yet magnetically, because he draws in the main character, played by Eva Green. You know, she has to give her all to him, and you kind of really feel the pain from her side. But he is just this magnetic presence that you can't say no to, basically. True Blood, I've not really given a go, but again, obviously it's not Dracula, but it's vampires. And I think that's along the same line as Twilight in terms of kind of the new, hip, modern, liberal type. Twilight is so bad in so many ways. But, I say that in the acting and the script. I just, bits of it, I'm like, Jesus.
Apart from that.
Yeah, but apart from that, you know, if without Twilight, we wouldn't have this extra layer. But, you know, the fact that someone's given it a go and said, yeah, sure, let's have sparkly vampires, you know, angsty teenage sparkly vampires. And there's a lot of people in the Twilight films that have gone on to do amazing things, like Michael Sheen's in that, Rami Malek's in that. I think Anna Kendrick's in it as well. So there's a lot in there that allows, kind of, if you're tracking the history of vampires in film, I think we should be grateful for it, even if it's a travesty.
It's just astonishing, though, the extent to which vampires have been kind of, I don't want to say commodified, but like my daughter, there's a show on one of the kids' channels that my daughter sometimes watches called Vampirina, for instance. So like,
that's amazing.
You can get these very, I mean, toothless vampire stories, pun intended.
There was Mona the Vampire,
yeah,
not that long ago,
and it's astonishing. So we need to be thankful, I think, to Bela Lugosi and, you know, the people who brought us the 31 Dracula, because whether you think it's the greatest Universal film or not, I think that they had a large influence on what came afterwards. And the film, I think, holds up pretty well. So yeah, feel free to check it out, listeners, and let us know what you think. And Rosie, thanks for your time tonight.
Do you have a list of puns, or are you just coming up with these?
I did Google Dracula puns this morning.
Excellent.
I'm ashamed to say.
No, I've enjoyed them.
Yeah, and one thing I forgot to mention right at the outset was this is actually the 50th episode of the podcast,
which is pretty cool.
Yeah, pretty nice to rack up a half century. I don't know, it's gone really quickly, which is odd. But yeah, Rosie, tell us where we can find you online if we should wish to.
If you should wish to. I'm on Twitter and Instagram at Rosie the Cat Lady.
Nice. All right. And listeners, you can find us in all the usual places, which is to say mainly Twitter at Movie Palace Pod, also on Facebook, also on Instagram. But thanks for joining us today, listeners. I hope you can join me next time when the curtain rises once again at the Movie Palace.